Aires. Este acuerdo fue alcanzado luego de la reciente reunión entre el director de la Oficina de Seguridad Surcoreana, Nam Kwang-pyo, y el viceministro de Asuntos Exteriores chino, Kong Soon-jung. Recordemos que el TAC fue desplegado en la pasada primavera, pese a la fuerte oposición de países claves en la región como China y Rusia. En ocasiones anteriores, Beijing ha dicho que el TAC supera las necesidades defensivas de Corea del Sur para poner en riesgo a toda la estabilidad regional. Además, no ayuda a resolver las preocupaciones de seguridad de Seúl respecto al programa de desarrollo nuclear de Corea del Norte. Todo lo contrario, aviva las tensiones.
El académico y escritor e investigador mexicano Alfredo Jalife participó hace unos días en la Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México en una charla sobre el tripolarismo de Estados Unidos, China y Rusia, así como de la cambiante realidad de los mexicanos en los Estados Unidos. Escuchemos.
Ya la cuestión de la droga en México, donde está causando una gran epidemia de opiáceos en Estados Unidos, sobre todo a la juventud blanca, que ni se casa, pues ¿quién se va a casar? Y además está desempleada. Pues ¿quién se va a casar con un desempleado drogadicto? O sea, no son masoquistas las blancas, ¿no? Prefieren los morenitos, brownies, se saben quiénes son, que además van muy bien en su tarea biológica, ¿no? Muy bien van. Y ya van a ser mayoría en 20 años. Bueno, a eso le tiene pavor Trump. Es una guerra demográfica que no se atreve a decir su nombre. Por eso yo tengo mucho miedo por México, se los digo de entrada. Yo temo a la balcanización del país, a una división, porque la manera de dividir el voto mexicano en Estados Unidos es dividiéndolo desde adentro. Dividen al país en tres zonas y pues también van a dividir a los mexicanos. Ahora, vean ustedes lo interesante. En Estados Unidos hoy los blancos son 62%, los latinos 18%. Del 18% de los latinos, el 80% somos mexicanos. Eso es importante. Nada más que aquí viene la situación. La tendencia demográfica de los latinos y los mexicanos es ascendente y la de los blancos es descendente. Es decir, va a llegar un momento en los próximos 20 años donde ya sea mayoría como grupo étnico los mexicanos. Obviamente el restante que queda de esa cuenta que hice, alrededor de, en el caso 15, son los llamados black people, ¿no? Muy respetables, por cierto, ya está, tuvieron un mulato ahorita de presidente, y eso le tasa a tierra a los blancos. Por eso llegó Trump, Vean dónde se da el voto de Trump, que además en Estados Unidos el voto no es popular, todos se equivocan. Y nosotros aquí la vimos, cuidado, cuidado con Trump. Porque estudiamos el voto electoral, que no popular, y nos dimos cuenta que tenía la mayoría del colegio electoral Trump. ¿Por qué? Porque ahí están los desempleados blancos, sobre todo en el Bible Belt, el cinturón bíblico, y en el Rust Belt, en el cinturón industrial, la región de Pensilvania, etcétera. Esa es la realidad. Es decir, fue una revuelta demográfica de los evangelistas blancos. Si nosotros no vemos eso, de los UAS, hay tan costoso. Lo que está sucediendo en Estados Unidos, y lo tenemos como reflejo en México, se está reflejando en los cuatro rincones del planeta. Y ahora, ¿por qué tiene gran impacto? Porque Estados Unidos era la superpotencia. Ustedes saben, venimos de una bipolaridad hasta que se derrumba la Unión Soviética en 1991, con la previa caída del muro de Berlín en 1989, con la salida de los soviéticos en Afganistán. Vean cómo en Afganistán ustedes se juegan mucho, gran parte de los nuevos órdenes mundiales, porque es una zona buffer muy importante. Y luego viene la unipolaridad cuando sucumbe la Unión Soviética. En 1991 se queda Estados Unidos solo en el planeta, enloquece con su especulación financierista, y resucita Rusia relativamente con Vladi, y luego China empieza a despegar cuando entra la OMC en 2001. Y ahí ven, bueno, es más, China estaba detrás de México, yo me acuerdo de esa gráfica, estaba detrás de México antes del 2001, y de repente entran a la OMC y despega China. Y ha sido uno de los avances más fulgurantes vistos en la historia de la humanidad. Estamos hablando de 1978, que ellos entran al modelo de Deng Xiaoping. Hasta la fecha ningún país ha tenido ese ascenso fulgurante. Además, los chinos, que no hay que subestimarlos, los ve chaparritos, ¿sí? Pues que no han ido a Sichuan. Son grandes inventores, toda su vida lo han sido. Pues no conocemos la historia de China. Vean el siglo XI, ellos no dominaron el mundo porque no quisieron. Veían al mundo como barbárico. En el siglo XI ya tenían la pólvora, tenían grandes embarcaciones, cuando Europa, todavía los europeos estaban en las ramas de los árboles, ¿no? Todavía no bajaban de ellos. Entonces, y luego la revolución industrial prodigiosa los lanzó, la han venido dominando, pero ya yo creo que ese ciclo ya acabó por sus guerras, sobre todo. dilapidado mucho. Nada más la guerra y los acosos de Irak le costó a Estados Unidos 3 millones de millones de dólares.
En Argentina, un joven inventor está sacando de la penumbra y la frustración a cientos de personas en todo el mundo, fabricando partes del cuerpo humano tridimensionales. Ricardo Romero viene con los detalles.
Esta simple acción de abrir una puerta y saludar era imposible para Uriel hace algunas semanas. Poder tomar agua agarrando el vaso sin ayuda es solo uno de los nuevos movimientos que incorporó este chico de 11 años al tener una mano impresa con tecnología 3D. Para este niño discapacitado, no tener una de sus extremidades significó la burla de sus amigos también.
De primera a cuarto sufrí bullying por mis compañeras. Sí, lo bueno es que me tocó un grado que no molesta ni nada este año.
Ah, bien.
Una maestra que por lo menos me defiende, que la otra no.
Uriel mueve sus nuevos dedos y considera su mano como algo parecida a las herramientas de un superhéroe. Sabe que para usarla bien hay que entrenar mucho. Por eso la utiliza en cada momento, incluso para hacer dibujos o escrituras con un bolígrafo adaptado. Si bien él sueña con hacer todo tipo de movimientos, su familia es cauta y sonríe porque el mundo es un poco más accesible para el pequeño.
O sea, desde chiquito uno piensa, bueno, ¿qué puedo hacer? ¿Qué no puedo hacer? ¿Cómo lo puedo solucionar? Por ahí hace 10 años atrás, 11, cuando él nació, no había nada. O sea, era lo que había y si te gustaba bien y si no, arreglate como puedas.
El caso de María Eugenia Caram es similar al de Uriel. Ella perdió su mano en un accidente cuando tenía solo 2 años. Durante más de 4 décadas vivió adaptando sus acciones por la ausencia de una extremidad. Ahora esta mujer argentina realiza nuevas tareas gracias a este diseño innovador. Uno de sus sueños era escribir. Hoy es un deseo cumplido.
Yo quería, en mi cabeza estaba la posibilidad de poder, qué se sentía escribir con la mano que no tenía. Así que te lo puedo resumir en eso, básicamente. Para mí la mano fue volver a tener la posibilidad de volver a escribir, que no es un detalle menor, ¿no?
Estas dos personas solo representan a cientos que recibieron sus impresiones en 3 dimensiones. El proyecto LIMS fue fundado hace 4 años por Gino Tubaro. Su objetivo fue ayudar sin pensar en el dinero. Por eso cada creación no tiene derechos de autor y su reproducción es libre. A esto se sumó que la Fundación Atomic Lab regala cada mano generada, lo que derivó en la expansión de la iniciativa fuera de la Argentina.
Como decías, el archivo está en internet. Está de forma...
Su carrera hacia 1963, con temas folclóricos, vinculados con las luchas sociales latinoamericanas. Su música se convirtió en un puntal del movimiento popular. Sus letras contestatarias fueron en ocasiones el pretexto utilizado por la dictadura militar para encarcelarlo y exiliarlo, pero no lograron acallar su voz y sus emotivas canciones. En los 80 publicó un disco en colaboración con Mario Benedetti. Trabajó también en programas de radio y televisión. Así continuó Biglietti siendo la voz de la justicia.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del informativo Farco, de Hispan TV, de Venezolana de Televisión y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it's the November 2nd, 2017 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. That's mostly me talking at you, interviewing other people, and running down what I think is important and what's been happening in Santa Cruz. Numerous interviews coming up, and updates on local protests against abusive landlord and rent stuff. So don't go away.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Press your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you.
So welcome to another edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. For newcomers, we are not a live show, but we're nearly live. This was recorded hours before broadcast time, 6 o'clock on the 2nd of November on Thursday. You can comment on what you've heard by calling in at 423-4833 or 423-HUFF, Huff. Huff is also the group I work with, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I'm a sort of contact person for Free Radio Santa Cruz in case you're interested in becoming a part of our Free Radio Collective or commenting on anything you've heard on Free Radio, which broadcasts at 101.3, as some of you may know, and also streams at freakradio.org. There are archives at freakradio.org, and there are bits of information such as application forms and a schedule of Free Radio. We're still looking for a studio space so we can actually restore our phone line and have live call-ins and also possibly coax back more broadcasters who have strayed. And in order to encourage folks, as regular listeners have endlessly heard, we do have a $500 reward if you can find us a place we can rent for a year. We're talking around $300 for a 10 by 10 space. It can be indoors or outdoors. The only concern is it have access to internet, power, and access to a bathroom. So give me a call at 423-4833 if you want to claim the reward, if you have any questions about Free Radio, or you can go to freakradio.org. And you can also contact me directly at that number. If I'm not there, I will return any calls if you leave me a return phone number. And maybe if you don't have a phone, a contact point, although my transportation problem is sort of difficult these days. I'm looking for a new car, the old one having died by the side of the road. Anyway, so that's the story for contact with 423-4833 if you have any comments about anything you've heard or updates, news briefs, concerns about discrimination or harassment, particularly concerned, of course, about the most basic survival treatment of homeless people outside in the Santa Cruz area. Now, I'm hoping to get an interview later in the show with Santa Cruz tenants' rights organizer Cynthia Berger, who was part of a rather colorful and lively protest at the Sleep Tight Apartments Tuesday morning. I went there too and did a lot of audioing, but I'm still working on that audio. I want to play it probably on Sunday, where we have a longer show from 9:30 to, well, sometimes as far as 2:30 or 3. But I'm going to try to set that audio for playment at 10. I had told participants that we were going to play the audio of the debates between the management and interviews with some of the activists and protesters and some of the residents who are concerned about being evicted without relocation money from buildings that the Santa Cruz, I guess it's the building inspector, the city anyway, is determined to be illegally uninhabitable. And apparently, according to the concerns of these activists, the relocation money the landlord is legally required to provide has not come. And if the tenants are evicted without relocation benefits, the activists feel they face houselessness and living out of their cars. Boy, I should try to buy one of their cars. Then they wouldn't have a house at all or even a place to sleep. Anyway, I want to play that at 10 o'clock on Sunday, November 5th, if I can. Hopefully it'll be ready by then. I'm still trying to work out some of the details. And what I'm going to, I think, begin with instead is a lengthy interview with activist Pat Malo on sort of goings on and stuff that's happening around the cannabis cultivation, dispensary, availability of both recreational and medical marijuana in Santa Cruz County and also to some extent in Santa Cruz City. Pat has been working with a number of groups, including the group that a couple of years ago forced the Board of Supervisors back on its heels by indicating they had enough signatures for an initiative to overturn their essentially reefer madness law. And then Pat served on the C4 committee, which the Board of Supervisors hastily put together to recommend changes, which they then largely ignored, but which apparently another committee that was concerned with environmental impacts didn't entirely ignore. It's a rather complicated subject. Pat gets into it in some detail. And if you are interested in this subject, this may be an interview that will be worth following. So I'm going to play it now. All right, well, today is October 28th, 2017. It's around noon, a little bit after, and I'm talking with activist Pat Malo, who is has a variety of credentials. He was on the C4 committee that was designed to the Board of Supervisors' response to a successful slap across the chops a couple years ago when they tried to really seriously cut back on cultivation in the county. And then, of course, recently, this spring, there was further action by the Board of Supervisors. And, of course, the big deal now coming up is the commercial sales that's going to be authorized to some extent at a state level. But for me, what's important, of course, as I always say to you, Pat, is access of low-income people to both medical and recreational marijuana. So I'm going to kind of focus on that, plus try to get an update from you on what's been happening and what's likely to be happening soon. I may be cutting in on you with questions at different points, so forgive me if I do.
No worries.
Hey, hello, Pat.
Hey, thank you, and yeah, lots of, we're in a chaotic transitional time, and like you said, they're moving into at the state level, a regulated commercial cannabis, set of rules and licensing schemes and things that hoops that everyone's going to have to jump through to participate in this legal commercial market. And, that is going to have probably the same effects that every other legal regulated product that's out there, where your access is determined by how much money you have. And it's not like the old, Prop 215 kind of unofficial legal protection system gave guaranteed access to anyone without money, but there was, you know, a kind of unofficial network of people who were allowed to produce in these collective models, and they often did a better job than the broader economy at taking care of people without means. And so that system is basically coming to an end.
Now, let me ask you, Pat, you were worried about a year ago with the passage of, well, previously with the state passage of SB, I don't know what number it was, that
a series of bills that became the MRCRSA state regulate or state legislation, and now it's all under SB 94. The state stuff is the folding in of ALMA and the.
And you were also concerned, as I recall, about the impact of the initiative, which, you know, was hailed by a lot of people as the be-all and the end-all, and then opposed by others who were concerned that it would cripple medical marijuana and seriously impact its accessibility. What's your sense of how that has played out?
Yeah, and so we're in the very beginnings of it starting to unroll. You know, people have basically been able to operate under the old set of rules, and now in December, the state's going to have the first applications for the temporary licenses that all these commercial actors are going to be required to go and get. And so we're already seeing the effects of the smaller, you know, entities, the smaller collectives, the smaller, you know, businesses not seeing a clear path because of the difficulty in obtaining local permission, the difficulty in, you know, jumping through regulatory hoops that cost money. And for, you know, a lot of, you know, people who were cultivating and selling a little bit of their excess at the dispensaries and taking that to pay their bills and taking the rest of the medicine to use for themselves and others, they're going to have to find a different way to supplement the garden costs and all that, because they're going to lose access to these dispensaries. And then, you know, these dispensaries and other ways, you know, delivery services or small collectives that were a little bit bigger than just those smaller personal gardens selling their excess, they're going to have to find a way to fit, you know, into this new state regulatory thing. And the state
Let me interrupt you, Pat, just asking, because now I'm going to kind of bring it to the local level. I've been concerned about essentially a reefer madness kind of drug war prohibition mentality in Santa Cruz, both at the city level and at the county level, both the city council of Santa Cruz and the board of supervisors of Santa Cruz County, and that's of course been one of the main things we've talked about in the past and I'm going to talk to you about today. But there's also been this taxing that has cracked down on medical marijuana, I think to the dismay of some activists who suggested that you don't tax medicine anyway, and that and also the kinds of restrictions that the cities and the county have placed even on medical marijuana dispensaries and cultivation has not been really justified by any safety or health concerns or even the number of complaints, but just been a sort of the continuation of the drug war mentality. What's your sense of how this has been going in Santa Cruz and how it's likely to evolve here?
So the Santa Cruz County just had a last Tuesday at the Board of Supervisors. They heard a report from county staff, and that was based on a report from a consulting firm about how, you know, the need to lower these taxes and to get the fledgling industry going and, you know, not to overburden, you know, the cost for patients, all these things. But then the recommendations of that was to essentially leave the tax rate the same at 7% and or drop it a little bit. And so the Board of Supervisors left it at 7% on the dispensaries and have
the reaction of the growers and the patients to this in terms of, you may recall a couple years ago, the reaction to severe restrictions by the Board of Supervisors, if not a complete ban on cultivation, was prepare to pass an initiative. Is there any such momentum to deal with repressive behavior by the county or even taxing behavior, which is a form of repression? I mean, what's going on with that?
Really upset about on, you know, the Board of Supervisors thing is that first it's, you know, I've been saying from the beginning that this is a tax on medicine and that this, you know, hopefully one day when you get the adult use recreational stuff, you'll shift the, take the tax completely off medicine. And so even though there had been talk of how that, you know, chatter, I would say, in this county for years about how that was a possibility, they also, you know, extended the clubs, the dispensaries' ability to do business in this new adult use marketplace. And so, but they didn't shift the tax off of the medical.
Before we leave that, I believe there was an individual who has been interviewed on Free Radio who actually tried a lawsuit against that, although the growers didn't support him. You may remember that.
Yep, and I think his went and was eventually dropped. There's serious issues about taxing medicine beyond what I think his specifics of his case were. That's the main thing. And then the other thing is that they're, you know, where the tax money goes is a big issue for me and, you know, the cannabis community. We want to see it going to provide access for patients to medicine with, you know, low income, very low income kind of stuff. But then we also want to see it used in good ways throughout the community and not necessarily used for what there was a large discussion on of how the enforcement of, you know, the people who aren't able to get into this regulated system, how the money's going to be used for that as well.
How has it, Pat, how has the money, because this tax has been in effect for a while, how has it been used in terms of enforcement? I know at a meeting with Hart last year, he promised, and I think you suggested in one of our conversations, that he actually came through on a promise to back off on a tax using regulations of, you know, or just destruction of marijuana cultivated areas. Before you answer that, that's something I'm interested in. But also, you didn't really answer my last question, which is, are growers and consumers, particularly patients, in any way concerned with repeating the success of the initiative drive that they did a couple years ago?
Well, and so there is some murmuring and bubbling, not mainly among patients, but of, you know, business owners. And this time, some of those are the biggest dispensaries and things. So we're looking into that. I'm always, you know, in favor of something like that, more to direct the money out of the general fund into specific programs that I think the community desperately needs.
How has the money been spent hitherto in the last year in your
information? Everything has gone into the general fund, basically. So it's, you know, the official answer is that things have gone into the general fund and then go to fund everything. But there was some initial requests a few years ago when the first tax on the dispensaries went through, and that was from, you know, sheriff for enforcement and code and, you know, planning department for a couple more code enforcers. So it's gone, bits of it have gone to enforcement, and then in the last, I think a year or so ago, when the new tax was passed on the other parts of the industry, Ryan Coonerty and Zach Friends had, the creation of a Thrive by Three program, which, you know, you can argue about how much money went there and whether it actually addresses the need, but it is a positive, you know, a more positive use than enforcement.
Tell us what that program is.
So that's a creation of, I think they voted on it on Tuesday as well, to the last, the actually funding numbers. So I think it directs around $270,000, which they're then able to get, you know, matching funding from other sources to take it to about, I think, $1 million for, you know, early childhood, you know, development for low income and, you know, at risk youth, basically. And so the, a big chunk of the, then everyone argues about where chunks of that money should go within things. And a big chunk of it, I know, has gone to a program that's been along for a few years that gives, kind of home visits to new mothers, for the first couple of years. I think that's where a chunk of it went. I think a lot of it, or other chunks not big enough, went to, you know, daycare places and service stuff like that. But
so none of this has any, Pat, none of this has much to do with, you know, the alleged concerns for which the fund was supposedly, or which, you know, the tax originally set up, like, you know, environmental damage and, you know, the great menace of the marijuana growers, that sort of thing. I mean, it's being essentially siphoned off into other things. Is it going to have an impact in driving out small growers, and distributors and consumers?
Yeah, I mean, the tax rate is prohibitive right now. And then when you beat for a lot of different sections of the industry, I mean, 7% gross is, for certain types is every bit of their margin they're operating on. So, so there hasn't been the largest participation amongst the other types of the industry as far as cultivators and manufacturers who are feeling really insecure of whether they're going to be able to make the next steps into this new, you know, regulated system, and so they haven't been paying as much. And and yeah, I think it's hard. It's got to get worked out, or else it's gonna, you know, be toughest on the people who the smallest participants who can least afford it. And then another thing on the tax stuff is that we're working on some sort of recommendations for the county in the one of the good C4 votes that things that came out of the long C4 process was a unanimous vote to you know, create some sort of low income, no income patient access program, because it was acknowledging that these new rules were going to make it harder on patients to get access. And so the county hasn't been, they've mentioned that, but they haven't created anything into their, you know, the rules, because they haven't had the new rules yet. But we're working on, actually, with the, you know, community prevention partners, people who have historically been, you know, kind of, you know, at odds with us from time to time. We've been participating and working on them with some recommendations of something to mandate some of that tax money go to, you know, giving medicine away to low-income patients, either, you know, mandated that the dispensaries and businesses give a chunk away, or the chunk of the tax money is used for it. So,
have you found the answer to the question that I posed to you, I don't think, 4 years ago in the studio, which is about the actual need for marijuana in terms, and the amount of marijuana that's produced, more or less, in Santa Cruz, and its accessibility in terms of existing dispensaries? Did you get any kind of sense of that?
So the, you know, the amount that is out there, there's been some interesting numbers that have come out about, you know, estimating the value of, you know, the Santa Cruz cannabis industry, and it's kind of backed up what, around what we've been guessing, that it's, you know, $500 million industry if you count the, you know, unofficial gray area and the soon to be regulated stuff. And the need, I would just say, is virtually never ending for people, you know, who have, that are, you know, in need of cannabinoids. I think we all are in desperate starving for cannabinoids, so I think the need is never ending, especially with the people with least resources. The amount that each, you know, dispensary has been giving away is different for each, you know, each one makes their own claims, and I've got a few that I know kind of offhand that, you know, Kind Peoples has been able to donate, you know, with help of their vendors and things, you know, $60,000 in the last year. You know, the Vets Alliance that recently got a club, they built into their model to give away 10% of everything they produce to veterans, and, you know, I think a few other places like the Cookie Company, I'm leaving stuff out, so I know basically all of them have their own little program, but there's no quantified, like, thing behind this. They all have their own claims, and there's no real way to measure what the other parts of the industry are all giving away, and so that's what we're hoping can be, you know, something that we can now build into this local licensing schemes and tax stuff. If we're going to have all that, we need to...
Yeah, I got you on that. You know, I'm just wondering, I talked to Leopold's aide, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, and he said that part of some of the original ordinance way back then did provide for some access to low-income marijuana in some way, and the response when I said was, where is it? His, oh, well, it's illegal federally. We're waiting for federal legalization of that. And I doubt there's been any change in that. But again, let me draw you back, and if you can comment on that if you want, but let me draw you back to the issue of, is there any muscle in the growers, consumers, and patients and distributors to fight undue restrictions? Because I understand, you remember you and I were talking before, and you were saying that the supervisors were proposing really severe cultivation restrictions. What's the status of that now?
So now we're in, so I don't know if you're, I've heard there's a long EIR process that is going for like the last year. So we finally got the draft EIR back, and the draft EIR argues what we've been arguing, is that, you know, the way the biggest issue with, you know, environmental impacts of this is with people who are not regulated and following no rules. And so having rules that are most inclusive, that bring as many existing, you know, cultivators and players into this as possible is the way to lessen the environmental impact. So the environmental impact report actually argues for the most permissive alternative that it studied, that does a lot of the things that we're...
And Pat, how does this compare with what the supervisors were proposing and are proposing?
So it gets rid of a lot of the big stumbling blocks of, you know, bans on Zach Friend's District 2 for outdoor cultivation. It recommends getting rid of the coastal zone plus a mile. It recommends being able to have multiple sites on these parcels. It drops the minimum acreage to 2.5 acres. So it's not perfect, but it does go, you know, quite a bit further than what the board's draft.
And how about Pat? How about setbacks and use on site?
So it doesn't have anything about you know, use special, you know, consumption, on site consumption, or special use for you know, these kind of events and things where you'd have on-site consumption, but it's because it's mostly studying the cultivation ordinance and their proposed manufacturing, which
at the city level, I was at the last one of the meetings of the city council a month ago or so, and their own staff was recommending the most permissive, and they didn't get the most permissive. Instead, we're going to have 5 dispensaries open in the city, and nowhere where when you can do an Amsterdam style walk in and, you know, it's okay to booze it up in a bar, but it's not going to be okay to smoke a joint in a, you know, in a cafe, for that purpose. Is there anywhere in the county that that's likely to happen? Is there any pressure for that?
No, and those are the issues that we're going to be working on after we get the, cultivation, manufacturing things figured out. And, yeah, those are the big picture stuff. I think that there needs to be more of a, you know, cafe model, and then there also needs to be places where people can, you know, use, not necessarily only on in businesses, but, you know, we've got dog parks and cigarette smoking zones. We should have places for people, you know, because the other big issue about that is that you can legally buy this stuff, but you can only legally use it if you have, you know, a house or a backyard. And, you know, one of the council people said it's like, you know, not everybody's got a backyard. And so what we're hoping too is that, you know, not only is there some, you know, public spots provided for this eventually, but then also that...
Well, let me interrupt you, because, I mean, your hopes are very interesting, but I'm more interested in your muscle, not your hopes, because I'm also interested in what the likely agenda is of the Board of Supervisors on this issue. I've seen the agenda of the City Council, and it isn't pretty. What's the story with the soups?
So, yeah, there's no, in my gauging of where everybody's at, there's no interest at this point to look at adding, if they were going to add on-site consumption, they would have done it in their additions to the dispensary ordinance, allowing them to do adult use sales. And so I think that it's going to be part of this longer push
What about Pat, the rest of the recommendations that this great environmental report that is not particularly, I haven't read it carefully, but, you know, and I've seen you kind of shepherding people into this legal process and haven't been too impressed with that, frankly, because it worries me that, you know, if you work closely with the government and the sheriff, I don't know, I have a problem with that, because I'm afraid it may dull your edge. You can talk all you want in sort of vague, glowing terms. Oh, someday we want this and someday we want that. But what about the muscle that might actually produce that or stop the most repressive stuff from happening?
Well, yeah, you know, and so I'm trying to help people who are interested in, you know, still remaining legal and not being, you know, put into this excluded point. So my work is to get many of those people included as they possibly can locally. And then I totally acknowledge that this is not going to be pretty, and it's not going to be, something that has room for everyone. So the other fold that we're, you know, attempting on working on is that when we get, finally, the county will say, this is the group that's excluded. This is the group that's allowed to participate. You know, so I'm trying to facilitate getting a group of people who are going to participate no matter what into, you know, these systems so that there's room for them.
Yeah, again, Pat, interrupting you, it seems to me that I'm still not getting a clear answer to the muscle stuff, because it seems to me...
Once we have there's a huge group of people who have... you know, who are about to hear an official no from the county when they've been being, you know, dragged along saying, oh, just do this, go through this next step, go through this next step. So, yes, we've been going through those steps, but also we're going to finally get the no, and we'll be for a large group, and then that group is going to be excluded and is going to be organizing to be included if they still, you know, want to be, and then also, you know, looking at how do we make enforcement, you know, not so barbaric and outrageous for the people who can't be included in this.
Well, last time,
that's the dual channels of work, and you know, people include, you know, participating with all this stuff, it's, you know, I've got a longer explanation for how that jives with making making big picture progress.
Pat, let me butt in here. Last time, you know, that you actually had a real impact, there was an initiative being circulated. Is there any kind of discussion about what the growers, the cultivators, the dispensers, the patients actually want as their focus, not what they can, you know, weasel out of the county or the city or the state, but what is in fact reasonable and what they would press for through an initiative process?
Yeah, we have a dish. Like I said, the EIR's most permissive alternative is pretty good, but it doesn't cover everything. So we have additions like the cottage cultivation stuff and the smaller parcel 1C licenses that we've been working on for over the last couple of years, and those are going in to be submitted to the EIR, and then we're going to work to have as much of that, you know, said the Board of Supervisors say yes to as much of that as they can, and then they'll say no to a chunk of it, and then that chunk will get, you know, pushed by other means, and if people have the ability to rally, you know, to do an initiative, I think that's what that will take to get the full package in.
So that's my question, Pat, that's my question. Is there much muscle there? Is there much organizing energy and resource there?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm saying, is that all the people who are organized trying to influence the county to be as inclusive as they possibly can are poised, and we've got language and things ready through these submissions that is, when the county says no to a chunk of it, then the people that they've just said no to hopefully can organize and, you know, have the resources to do it. And, you know, I've gone on the record a million times saying if I had the money that I just push this idea only, but I still think that some people have to go through the motions, even if you're, I try not to be naive about getting all this stuff out of the county. It's just that you have to keep pushing on all fronts in order to be able to be successful, and if we were ever had the opportunity.
So Pat, where can people get a clear sense of the program that you and others feel should be adopted, but it is not likely to be adopted and will have to be pushed once you get the big no from the soups?
Well, so if anyone is on, you know, if anyone's on the Cannabis Advocates Alliance email list, it's going to go on that. It's also going to go out on the Green Trade Santa Cruz list, so you can go to greentradesantacruz.org. That's like the business organization that we've been organizing, and so that we, in the next day or two, are putting out basically our EIR recommendations, and that is more or less a complete ordinance, and so those are going to be our recommendations with some, you know, shining and tweaks to, you know, lobby the county until they accept an ordinance, and it's also something that we can, you know, be developing for other means, you know, on the...
And can you, I'm sorry, can you repeat once again where people can go
The easiest way, if you're not signed up for the Cannabis Advocates Alliance email list, or if you're not already on the Green Trade email list, it's greentradesantacruz.org. And, you know, there's a bunch of membership information and things like that you don't have to fill out, but you can just fill out the email thing.
And what's coming up in terms of meetings? In other words, what should people be alerted to in terms of both Cannabis Advocates Alliance, Green Trade meetings, and also our beloved Board of Stupid Vipers?
Yep, so we had last Sunday, we had a little less than a week ago, we had a kind of SCM Square, Green Trade, CAA, EIR Common Drive thing. And so we don't have any other scheduled meetings for either group for this month at this point. So all I can say is just get on the email list and we'll we'll see where the next one comes. But we'll, and I don't know when the next Santa Cruz City issue, if it's coming up, in, I think that it'll be in the second city meeting in November, but I could be wrong about that, and I don't know when the next Board of Supervisors thing is going to be as far as cannabis issues. I know that they're going to be receiving the final EIR in hopefully by January and working on this ordinance in after that in as early as February, March. So,
do you know if any localities are actually providing for cannabis use cafe type places in California or in any of the other states where sales and cultivation have been legalized for non-medical recreational use?
Yeah, I don't know specifically in California where, you know, who has, I know that there's been medical, over the years there's been medical dispensaries where they've had on-site consumption, you know, some of the ones in San Francisco used to have it, in Berkeley and things like that. So I don't know anyone that's currently doing it, and I don't know anyone who has gotten local permission for one of these on-site consumption places. So, but I assume that we're going to be seeing, because we haven't seen the rollout of any public or any 21 and up adult use stuff. And so I'm sure over the course of the next year, we're going to be seeing other places having things like that. And so hopefully we can see them in Santa Cruz one way or another.
Is there anything, Pat, we've missed in this conversation? I'm sure there probably is, but anything that comes to your mind that you want to bring up?
I am, first off, terrified of this future. I don't want to act like this is, you know, something that the cannabis community is excited about, really. I mean, there's a huge shared anxiety at every level of the industry that I know about, you know, whether, you know, people are going to still be able to have their livelihoods in the future. And that's from the, you know, smallest people who have no intention or ability to get into this regulated system, and the biggest people I know, because of the tax burdens and the new, you know, big investment capital that's coming in and is going to be out competing even the largest people that we know about. So it's a scary time. What we're working for by any means basically is to get all of these legacy gardeners of Santa Cruz together and try to have at least one place in the state where small people can still participate legally. And so it's a tough job, and I don't claim to have the answers or be doing a adequate job even, because this is an impossible task. Everybody's just doing their best and figuring it out as we go, but your points are well taken that the only way that we've had anything is through the muscle. And so I'm always trying to, you know, get the muscle going at the same time as trying to get people through the hoops so that we can have the right alliances and the right policy to muscle through, if that makes any sense. That's my big picture thing. Other than that, I know that you've had lots of work with the issues right now, the crackdown on moving people out of downtown Santa Cruz, don't have a place to sleep, and now they appear to all be under the county's nose right now in San Lorenzo Park, and I hope that the county can act on that as well as getting real solutions for cannabis stuff. So, you know, bigger world than just weed out there, like I know you know, but thank you for, all your work and being willing to talk to us about the weed problem.
Well, maybe the San Lorenzo campground folks can start their own marijuana gardens. That could always
happen. That would be, it's been a really sunny last couple months, so they could have been doing something productive down there. instead of having, you know, everybody chase them around and have, make life harder, I think that there's tons and tons of awesome work in the community to be done, and there's tons of awesome people that have given, you know, an opportunity to do that work. I think cannabis would be a perfect, you know, I think the county and the city should have their own gardens and be putting people to work and having it be little weed incubator projects. So,
you know, there is this office, there an office of medical marijuana, compassionate use, or whatever it is, that supposedly was created some years ago that now the support of, or the city council wants to abolish. I don't know if you've been aware of that, but it's, you know, it's been defunct since Rotkin and others created it, but then said, oh, there's nothing we can do because the feds are illegal. Of course, this is the same time that, you know, they were celebrating WHAM and shutting down all the other dispensaries in the city with the zoning restrictions in order to, you know, pander to essentially, you have a pro-marijuana majority, I think, in Santa Cruz. That was shown by the vote with for proposition, you know, the proposition that created the lowest enforcement priority and the a commission, the city commission that has since been essentially crippled by the city attorney and by the appointments of the board of or I should say the city council. I guess I'm kind of jumping around here, but I'm wondering if there's any other city in California, you know, that is facing the similar kinds of, I'm sure there are, problems that have suggested different things that you have found instructive and helpful in your own attempt to propose solutions.
Yeah, I mean, so the first off, it's, you know, I know that that committee has been sitting there doing nothing. That's unfortunate. And what was my biggest fear was it was actually brought up to repeal that lowest priority from enforcement, whatever that measure, I think it was Measure K.
That's correct. Measure K. Yeah.
And so that was really scary. And I mean, that hopefully that doesn't get, you know, doesn't have legs, and I haven't heard any more about that. But then as far as other models, I think that we're really lacking, because this is all happening so fast, this new, you know, regulation thing. So I think there's certain things in places like, you know, Oakland, as far as giving licenses, to, you know, smaller, cultivators and giving priority for, you know, women, people of color, historically disadvantaged communities. I think that's great, but I don't think anywhere has a model that you can just follow. And so I think that there's tiny bits of what's happening in Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz County and Santa Cruz City that are positive, but I think that we're yet to see a model that's repeatable. So, you know, again, hopefully Santa Cruz can be that model. But I wouldn't necessarily gamble on anything anywhere emerging that is, you know, what I would consider adequate.
Well, Pat, you've done a 15-minute interview in 45 minutes, for which I thank you.
Yep, that's usually my style.
It's not, well, I have enabled you, and also, you know, and interrupted you repeatedly in order to, you know, kind of keep the focus on what I want focused on. I appreciate your patience.
Oh, yeah, no, I have no, you know, I'm always patient and always enthusiastic, and, you know, I've got my own reasons for doing everything, but I like your critiques, and I like that you're still interested in us and what we're doing.
Okay, well, that's all I've got. Anything you want to say?
Nope, nothing other than, I've been following, you know, I've been following your emails about everything, and I'm, you know, I'd be interested in, in your maybe 1 minute thoughts on what's happening and is the enforce, you know, the saying they're not going to enforce the sleeping ban for these hours. Is that really, is anything but just more of the same? Kind of just from my interested in your perspective.
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's one that we talk about on my twice weekly show a lot, or does come up a bit. And of course, you know, you're getting a lot of people who are praising Police Chief Andy Mills
yep.
for his public statements on that, his statement that, you know, if you're on public property and there isn't a, you know, health and safety problem, I'm not quite sure if that's exactly his words, that you will be left alone to sleep, and that not only that, Parks and Rec Rangers don't in, he hasn't said this, but people have suggested that Parks and Rec Rangers aren't going in after 9 o'clock at night to harass, and they're separate agencies, so, and they've been giving out in the past a lot of stay-away orders and tickets. But, of course, the skepticism of some people, and I share it to some extent, is that this is sort of the first step in a removing homeless people from visible places in the downtown, which some people say, well, that might be a good thing because, you know, first of all, it's people need a little privacy. They need to be off to the side. But if people are visible, then the problem is real. Once they start disappearing, then suddenly if the problem can be ignored. And that is what, of course, the standard approach in Santa Cruz is. It's, I have not heard a lot of examples of people who have been getting tickets in the last few weeks.
Yep.
I have heard people being moved away from the downtown area, secondhand stories, but not away from San Lorenzo Park. So, and also I've heard that tents have been allowed during the day in San Lorenzo Park. That's what activist Brent Adams has recently told me in an interview that I think we're playing on the same show that we're playing this interview with you. So that's my two-minute, one-minute discussion of your question there.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I've noticed firsthand, and I know that when they're talking to the business community, they're saying, oh, yeah, this is our plan to get everyone out of downtown, you know. And so I was just wondering, and I've walked through the park regularly and to see the tent set up but flattened, and I was assuming that was just part of the unspoken rules of to just flatten your tent during the day, but I still see people sleeping in those flattened tents. And it seems like a improvement in some senses that it's not, you know, there's, if they're really not ticketing people and giving people some safe-ish space, but it's, you know, I agree 100% that it is all about pushing people out of the downtown area to make it look much nicer, and so you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff when, you know, you're shopping. And so I was just interested in your, you know, perspective on the whole thing, and so what's, you know, where it goes from here, because I don't see it as, I see it as phases of pushing it further and further out, and my, you know, joke that's not a joke is there, so are they just going to reopen up Poganip, you know, because 10 years ago, that's where a lot of stuff was, undesirable activities was pushed into that area or whatever.
I think the point is also well taken that the city council, which has jurisdiction over San Lorenzo Park, though, as you pointed out, it's visible from county authorities insofar as they're right there, although the sheriff's offices, I guess, have generally moved out. But, you know, they're still, you know, county is right there, too. But it's city activity, and city has recently increased restrictions and police powers over the rangers and for police around stay-away orders. So, for example, you know, if you get, I think you've read my stuff on that. People have been familiar with that.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna leave it there, but I would encourage you to tune into my show and hear all of it.
I always try. I love all free radio stuff, and I love the, you know, I read the little Norse Report updates. So thank you, and always appreciate your work and time.
Do you often remember the day the soldiers came, and you became a number, not a child with a name? How oft do you recall that specific day when they sold your family home and sent you away? Banished to the desert to live in hot tar shacks, having no idea if you'd be ever coming back. How oft do you recall walking to the school, being taught about the glories of democratic rule? As you sat beneath
the watchtower surrounded by a wall, with liberty and justice for all. Do you often remember the young men allowed to leave, to go fight and die in Europe, their families left to grieve? Shacks there in the desert, locked behind a gate, as he went to class each morning in these United States. As you sat beneath the watchtower, surrounded by a wall, with liberty and justice for all. Do you often remember reciting those strange words as you held your hand on heart? Did it all seem so absurd? One nation indivisible, one nation under God, condemned to live behind the wire by a presidential nod. As you sat beneath the watchtower, surrounded by a wall, with liberty and justice for all. You often remember the day your family was set free, and you went back to the coast beside the Pacific Sea, without a home to go to, no soil left to till. When you'd recite the pledge each morning, was it a bitter pill? Did you recall the watchtower surrounded by a wall, with liberty and justice for all? Did you recall the watchtower surrounded by a wall, with liberty and justice for all? With liberty and justice for all.
And that was David Rovick's Liberty and Justice for All, of course, about Frank Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 back in 1942, during World War II, which set up the Japanese concentration camps on the West Coast. And I paused before playing that one in previous shows because it's really become a sort of a fashionable, acceptable form of self-criticism in the United States, particularly in the sort of the liberal community, to lament the incarceration of innocent Japanese Americans, actually, allegedly because of the threat of invasion by the Japanese. And it's, I'm sure there's a lot of racist discrimination that continues. I don't know how sure I am in terms of documentation. It's my suspicion there is. But it's not really the pressing issue that, discrimination against blacks and women and homeless and elderly and disabled. It is, but at least it's being acknowledged, at least that historical aspect of it. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. You were listening, of course, before that, to Pat Malo and myself going on about, at some length, about the current status and likely prospects of folks who want to be able to grow, purchase, use, sell, buy marijuana, both medically and recreationally, in Santa Cruz County. So I didn't make it downtown for the Halloween festivities, but apparently the Sentinel did, although I hate to amplify the Sentinel's account, since I don't really regard them as a particularly inclusive, reliable, or unbiased news source. Let's put it this way, their bias is not mine. There's a picture of Santa Cruz police and a California Highway Patrol officer confiscating beer from a Halloween reveler with a triple fine citation issued for open container. Halloween is one of the few times, I think July 4th is another, New Year's Eve is another, when people gather. In the downtown, it's a spontaneous thing. It's not run by the Downtown Association or by the Santa Cruz Neighbors or by the Santa Cruz City Council or by the Santa Cruz Police. It's a spontaneous gathering of the community. And, of course, this, I think, makes the police department and the established officials feel threatened because,
You might say maybe they're afraid they're going to be blamed for, quote, crimes that happened during that time. But actually, I think they're concerned that people will start exercising their power and understand that as a community, they have a right to do what they want, regardless of the strictures put upon them by an unrepresentative and class-biased city council, and by an unrepresentative, even more unrepresentative, city manager, Martine Bernal. Though we are losing the assistant city manager, Scott Collins. I said goodbye to him today and gave him a little rubber ducky as a parting gift. I got to admit, I'm ashamed. I actually like Scott Collins as a person, although I told him I can't stand his policies. He's off to Morro Bay to get a higher job, more pay, more responsibilities, he says, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, I ran into him today at City Council offices while I was researching Parks and Rec's many, many, many citations for in their class war against poor people in the parks, the Greenbelt area along Pacific Avenue, as part of their sort of slave catcher control function, or their lower class control, or their control of people who are considered to be a potential threat, not because they are threatening injury to individuals, but because the reality of a lot of people who are poor and hungry and a few people who have a lot of wealth and are controlling a real estate and rental property and own a lot of property is that there be a challenge to the social and economic order. And that is, I think, even though it's not explicitly stated, maybe not even understood or acknowledged as such by the police force, really what's going on. And really, it's shown in the arrest records. It's shown in how people of different classes are discriminatorily treated. And in terms of some of the actual facts, though, whether you can get the same story from the Sentinel article of November 2nd, today, there were 9,000 people downtown, according to the Sentinel's estimate. No violent crimes, but 100 cops from Santa Cruz, Capitola, Watsonville, Scotts Valley, UC Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz City Parks, Santa Cruz County Probation, and California Highway Patrol organizing, quote, the most organized event response Police Chief Andy Mills has seen in about two decades of law enforcement. Of course, now he wasn't here last year, and he's from a much smaller town, Eureka, up north, so he hasn't seen what Vogel did last year or the year before, and for that matter, I don't remember the details, nor have I heard of anyone giving the contrast. However, according to the Sentinel writer, Mike Todd, that response by all these cops required last-minute regrouping to protect against terrorist attacks by vehicle after the motorist in the truck killed 8 people Tuesday in Manhattan. And so we had cops added to the patrol throughout the remainder of the city to address neighborhood safety and complaints of large parties. And again, of course, they're crediting themselves, police are, with the lack of violence. I have no idea. It was the second in the consecutive year, according to the Sentinel, with a decline in violations on Halloween in Santa Cruz. Second year that Halloween was on a weekday. Last year it was raining, and there were 1,000 more people participating than this year. So maybe people are less inclined to turn out because I when I was last down there, I may have been down there last year or the year before, but they were, for a number of years, putting huge Klieg lights in the center of the street, marching up and down in military formation in groups of 6. Now, this year, apparently, Mills used a somewhat more friendly-looking approach. There's a picture of him and Deputy Chief Dan Flippo greeting a young person in a police call box costume, cardboard costume. They logged 18 arrests on Halloween, 15 of which were for open containers and public urination. And, of course, there's no mention of how many porta potties or bathrooms were open down the street. There probably were more than usual, or at least on a typical night. Would have to be, given the reality of the public response. Violations resulted in triple fines. There were also 42 citations in addition to the 18 arrests, which again were for having a beer or having an open container. And the idea that you're going to arrest someone for this rather than for a real behavioral problem is something that homeless people face all the time. Citations were issued last year in 2016 on Halloween. There were 20 arrests and 40 citations, so it was about the same. And there were 24 triple fine violations last year on Halloween than this year, so they're making more money if they can collect it from people they're giving triple fine tickets to. In 2015, they had 27 arrests and 73 citations. That's down from then. A quoting of Police Chief Andy Mills, that he made arrests right off the bat to thwart criminal behavior, set the tone, we're not going to tolerate gang members causing problems. We were able to create that atmosphere. And, of course, the atmosphere, I think, I don't know, I wasn't there, but I wonder if that atmosphere wasn't sort of, there's a bunch of goose-stepping Gestapo types around, heavily armed, who are going to harass you, take your money and your liberty if you don't pay real close attention to what their perception of how things should go is, regardless of what, let's say, the law is, or what the mood and tolerance of the crowd is, or what the realistic situation is in terms of what people in the group tend to expect and will appreciate or go along with. You can read all about it in the Ascent Anal, as I like to call it. And I don't know what to comment on, except, well, what I've already said, probably showing my prejudices. Rainstorms are projected for tomorrow and the next day, and that means it's going to be cold and wet for those outside. But for this year, for the first time explicitly in a number of years since Camp Paradise, actually, there's a tent city up in San Lorenzo Park, or at least reportedly for the last three weeks or more. Well, throughout October, there has been a tent city, and before as well, in San Lorenzo Park. Will this continue? Or will it be dispersed by the police and the rangers using the opening of the Association of Faith Communities winter shelter, which can't possibly handle all the people who are in San Lorenzo Park and the rest of homeless people as well, since that got about 100 beds or a little less, maybe a little more. Not sure exactly how many. And, you know, we're talking 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people. And the Santa Cruz Weekly this week has an article by Tom Gagola, whoever he may be, Root Force, with some counties seeking DEA help. Does California need a crackdown in order for cannabis to thrive? A thriving black market for cannabis would imperil the newly legalized framework. Officials from around the state aren't sure how to crack down and whether or not they should be asking the feds for help. So this... In the liberal Santa Cruz, at the liberal Santa Cruz Weekly, we have what looks like a story planted by the police. Or, you know, a sympathetic police mentality. When in fact, of course, what you've had for years is this insane discrimination between marijuana and much more toxic substances like tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceuticals, both medically and recreationally, and you still have it, as I've pointed out repeatedly on this show, and you probably heard this discussion in the Pat Malo interview that we just had. And of course, the focus of the article is still, well, gosh, maybe they'll need the feds to come in and stop the black market forces, which, of course, are being encouraged by the restrictions that are being put on growers and distributors here in the Santa Cruz City and county area. So an update by Bob Gelko from the Chronicle from yesterday's paper news. BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, can evict a group of homeless people from an encampment. That would be the here and there, or first they came for the homeless encampment, that regular listeners heard activist Mike Zint defending and promoting in one of my earlier shows. Camp that they've occupied since January, that is the
campers have occupied it, on the transit system's property, which really doesn't clarify that it's actually an unused piece of property next to the elevated section of the BART line right at the edge of the Berkeley-Oakland border. The federal judge ruling Tuesday saying a transit agency has no legal duty to provide housing or shelter. Actually, what Zint has pointed out through documents released is that it's not just the BART authorities, but it's actually the mayor of Berkeley, Jesse Arguin, who has colluded with this attempt to, again, move along the encampment that has been busted, 15, 16 times, and their response is, we'll begin the poor tour, as they call it, again, and move to another spot. Even though they've been successful where they are, they've gotten community support, they've been able, they claim, to get people into better situations, help them get off drugs, if that's a matter of importance to some folks. There was a nearby encampment that, in which a person overdosed and died, as though that were something to crack down on everybody else for. And that was the pretext used by BART and the Berkeley authorities for cracking down on both encampments. And who knows, perhaps encampments throughout Berkeley. 30 people, this story continues, have been living at the encampment near Martin Luther King Jr. Way and Alcatraz Avenue, just west of the tracks, as they descend from overhead to underground since Berkeley police evicted them from other parcels in the area. After BART officials posted an eviction notice on October 21st, encampment residents filed suit in the name of an organization called First They Came for the Homeless, claiming they were being punished for being homeless. U.S. District Judge William Alsup issued, actually being visibly homeless, I suppose, U.S. District Judge William Alsup issued a temporary restraining order on October 24th that blocked the eviction while the opposing sides prepared their cases. But on Tuesday, Alsup denied a permanent injunction and said BART officials could evict the encampment after giving the residents 72 hours to remove their property. And that's, I guess it'll be up Friday afternoon or something, tomorrow. Under BART policy, the residents would then have at least another 2 weeks to reclaim any items left behind the agency had placed in storage. While sympathetic to the plight of the plaintiffs and the problem of homelessness, which is ever more severe, the court must be faithful to the law, Alsup said in his ruling. Of course, the law, as we know, in its austere majesty, forbids both the rich and the poor to beg in the streets, sleep under bridges, or steal bread. That is to say, it's very equal in these matters. This was issued after a hearing in his San Francisco courtroom. The transit agency's actions in reclaiming its property, said, do not amount to the criminalization of plaintiff's status as homeless, given any place to go, and they had no reason to consider that anywhere else on any public property in the area they would be treated differently. Although, of course, in Oakland, many encampments have arisen under underpasses and freeway areas and so forth, and it's becoming so utterly visible and so overflowing that it's something that can no longer be, authorities can no longer easily pretend that this is something that, there's a bunch of bums have just decided to have a carefree lifestyle. Now they're using things like, oh, well, we need to forcibly incarcerate these people and forcibly drug them because, you see, they're mentally ill. That's one of the reasons they're there. Another reason is that we're being too nice to them because we're providing all these wonderful facilities and not sending out Gestapo teams with more regularity to drive them away from the places they're sleeping in. Or drug addicts that we shouldn't care about anyway because they don't want to get treatment and they're a health hazard to the community. Actually, of course, the health hazards, people can't wash their hands because bathrooms are closed to poor and homeless people outside often, and there's no washing facilities, though. That's one of the reasons we have, you know, at least a couple of washing facilities that have appeared in Santa Cruz, though nowhere near enough. And a couple of porta potties with washing machine—not washing machines, but washing stations—nearby, because compassion, no, it's just it's a matter of not wanting to see the San Diego hepatitis A epidemic essentially become, well, have Santa Cruz an epidemic just as widely publicized, yeah, in San Diego. According to, again, today's Sentinel, there is a report of the 20th death from hepatitis A, worst of its kind in 20 years, according to the AP, no idea. Eric McDonald, chief of the county's Epidemiological and Immunization Services branch, told the San Diego Union-Tribune, the 67-year-old man who appeared to be recovering suddenly relapsed and died on October 26th. More than 530 people have fallen ill and more than 360 have been hospitalized since November 2016. Most of the deaths have been among the homeless population. The contagious liver-damaging illness lives in fecal matter. Brown, the governor, declared a state of emergency last month to allow the state to buy vaccines directly from manufacturers and distribute them. San Diego County has vaccinated more than 90,000 people in recent months. And Huff, incidentally, yesterday had a meeting. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And they voted to... I don't think the actual vote was to encourage vaccinations, but to encourage authorities to respect the wishes of those, I think many of whom want to be vaccinated, but do not want to be forced to, for example, give up their social services if they, whatever choice they make. Because there's a number of people, housed people and homeless people, who feel that vaccinations can be dangerous in and of themselves. And this doesn't include the vote that we took yesterday on dealing with people who have active cases, but having to do with people who are not active but who want to maintain their freedom of choice, we believe that's an important thing. Just as we believe a person should not be forced to go to a shelter if they don't want to do it, because the conditions in shelter are notoriously bad. And it's not just this, oh, they don't want to follow the rules. It's the, if you knew what the rules were, and you had to also take care of your property and be near it, and you weren't allowed to do that, or bring in a friend or loved one or loved service animal who the authorities decide isn't a service animal, or you had bad experiences in shelters before, or you're a vet who just needs to be outside, all this stuff, or you like to make your own decisions rather than be ordered around at 4 o'clock in the morning as though you're in an army but you're not even being paid for it, then that's one of the concerns that are simply dismissed by bigots and ignorant people as people who don't want to follow rules.
Owen Brown was an abolitionist. John was Owen's son. He grew up in New England. He was born in Covington. John Brown was a tanner and a man of many skills. He stood up for the workers who toiled in the mills. He stood up for the Indians. He stood up for the women, for the oppressed and the exploited. This good man stood with them. So when Kansas was bleeding, he went and joined the fray. If the slave trade wanted Kansas, the slave trade would have to pay. Riding through the Kansas Prairie with a fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. With 2,000 of New England's best and bravest sons, Captain Brown fought in Kansas with a Bible and a gun. When Free Lawrence was on fire, lighting up the night, the ruffians would flee, John Brown would stand and fight. Lincoln called him a fanatic, and he was a Christian who thought you should do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. Christ said, love your neighbors, and if your neighbor's held in slavery, he was one who felt his duty was to fight to set them free. Riding through the Kansas Prairie with a fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah. Beecher's Bible in his hand. Bible in his hand. He drove the slave trade out of Kansas, then wrote to bordering Missouri.
raided the plantations, no compromise, said he. Broke the chains and shackles, rode at night to Canada. Out of the nightmare, the devil's home, America. He was caught in Harper's Ferry, his family lying dead. They questioned him for hours as he lay there and bled. They hanged him on the gallows, they laid him in his grave. John Brown was a Christian, and he died to free the slave. Riding through the Kansas prairie with a fine and loyal band. Glory, hallelujah, Beecher's Bible in his hand. Glory, hallelujah, Beecher's Bible in his hand.
And that was another one by David Rovics, recorded at the end of March of this year. He was the abolitionist who drove the forces of slavery out of Kansas in the 1850s through the force of arms and conviction, according to the additional legend that's written here, the original wording. You can find this on YouTube, as well as numerous other songs from David Rovics, who distributes them for free. And encourages you to show, although we do not have a station at the moment, we are still a collective, we're still broadcasting, and we're still streaming. Call 423-4833, area code 831-423-4833. So I'm on the line with 10 minutes, for 10 minutes, with Cynthia Berger, who is an activist with folks fighting landlord, I call it landlord oppression. What would you call it, Cynthia?
Well, it's kind of just the whole capitalist system of the United States that places property owners' rights very far above non-property owners.
And
we're kind of like second-class citizens.
Not to mention rents are exorbitant and rising and rising and rising.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the capitalist supply-demand attitude towards housing.
So what were you doing on Tuesday? I mentioned very briefly there was a protest at the Sleep Tight Apartments. What was that about, and what's followed up from it?
Well, for me, it's about a landlord who has not been maintaining his property. In fact, that particular property has never been maintained as it should be, but because poor people live there, the city is conflicted about it. They don't want to just kick poor people out right now in the middle of a terrible rental market, but at the same time, they've given these landlords, the succession of two or three landlords who've owned that place, lots of extra time to make things up to code for like 40, 50 years, and they're still not up to code. Like, they've never made them fix the electric system there, which is a fire hazard. So, and also another thing I found out about the landlords, that the owners of that property, that they haven't paid property taxes for the last 3 years. This is all public information. And so they haven't, you know, they get to not pay their property taxes of thousands of dollars to the city. And meanwhile, the city gives them a break by giving them months and months to fix something that should have rightfully been fixed 25 years ago, because Rhonda's lived in that place on and off, you know, since probably 35 years ago, you know, several different times, and it's never been fixed up.
Well, I remember, Cynthia, I actually walked inside the apartment with you, and there was mold all over the floor of the bathroom, or at least in certain parts of it. It was
shoebox-sized place. What other problems did you see that the apartment had?
Well, it has the floor, you know, you can see through to the dirt underneath the house. So, you know, let's just say it's not insulated. And it has some holes in it. And that was supposed to have been fixed. And that's been like that a long time. If he would fix it up, it could at least be legal. The wiring system is not up to code. And that's dangerous because things can catch on fire if the wiring isn't working right and if it isn't up to code.
Who is the landlord, Cynthia?
Well, it's kind of interesting because if you look it up, the owner is listed as Jerry Idem, I-D-E-M, I think is how it's spelled, or it's either I-D-E-M or E-I-T-E-M. And he was the owner for many, many years. And now he sold it to Greg Malley. So Greg Malley is the current landlord, at least. But from what I understand, he may be behind on his payments, so the other guy is still the owner. So this guy, Greg Malley, he's from Los Altos. And he bought this place for $1 million. And it's just a little dump. So people were speculating by spending that much money, they think they're going to fix it up and charge $2,000 a unit for these little boxes that went through the floods in the 1950s and were like covered up to their roofs in flood water. You know, and after that, they should have been raised, but they weren't. You know, they should have been just torn down, but they weren't. And so he bought this, he was supposedly buying this place and was going to fix it up. But, he, you know, like so many slumlord mentality landlords, he just wanted to do some cosmetic things, not spend money. And because he's looking all around him in the city of Santa Cruz, there's plenty of crappy properties that are charging $2,000 or $2,500 a month. So he didn't feel the need to upgrade the property. This is the same thing that happened at Cypress Point, probably the largest apartment complex in the city. They were just sold to a new company, a corporation, and they're not fixing up the things that need to be fixed up. They're just raising the rents.
When I got to the, Cynthia, when I got to this protest, there was numerous signs, you know, raising issues about landlord exploitation, but the particular publicity that was put out about the protest had something to do with relocation funding not being provided and some
yes,
sort of city
okay, yes, sure.
and a city so, inspector and a city inspector being due to get to the property. Can you clarify that and say what happened?
Yeah. So I did have a conversation actually later in the day with that or yesterday with that inspector, Jacob Rodriguez. He's from the rental inspection program, I think, not the code compliance department, but all of them are underneath the planning and community development department. So there are maybe different two or three different pots of money that pay inspectors. So Jacob was there. That's his place that he, you know, is one of his places on his roster of properties to take care of. And they have been working, you know, here's what they say, well, we're working with the landlord, right? But are you working with the tenant? So Jacob sees himself as providing tenant services with what he does. You know, there's some truth to it. I was just explaining to him how much more tenant services there could be besides what he does. But, yes, but anyway, so he's now going to extend the period of time that Greg has to fix his place. So people who've been living there forever in a crappy place, they just get to wait and wait. They don't get their rent reduced or anything, you know. But they're supposed to live in a legally habitable place, but yet they're paying rent to live in an illegal place. And if they red tag it and tell them they have to go because it's an illegal place, well, then that's really hard on the tenants, because then they have to leave within 48 hours. So this is why they work with the landlords, you know.
What about the relocation stuff, the funding?
So, okay, yeah, sorry. The city of Santa Cruz has a relocation ordinance that provides 2 lousy little months' rent if your place gets red tagged and you have to move out in 48 hours. But there's no one who guarantees that you ever get that money. That's the law, but nobody enforces it. So tenants, you know, I don't know how often they ever get that money. You know, they get that money if some other organization gets involved and is watching and monitoring. Otherwise, there's a lot of landlords that will just rip tenants off. There may be, there's lots of nice landlords that won't too, but there's plenty that will just rip them off and not pay them that money. And that money isn't enough, you know, it's enough for a hotel for a month, maybe at the most, 2 months rent. And what if they're paying, they have to pay market rate rent for the size of the unit they're in. They have to pay that to the tenant, the landlord. Or they have to pay them whatever their rent is that they're paying, whichever one is more. So these people would probably he's probably charging around market rate for some of those places. I know, you know, this one person's paying $1,600 for a very small, it's really a studio that with a small bedroom packed into it, you know. So it's like a very small one bedroom. It's just a little tiny beach cottage. And that's $1,600 for one that has a hole in the floor and a, you know, bad wire and dripping showers. A few years ago, there was gas main broken by a careless worker by the same landlord. Stuff, you know, it's just... So they're supposed to get that money, but they were supposed to get that money. It's unclear. He was already red tagged, and he was supposed to pay them. Like, he was red tagged. He was supposed to have it fixed by October 22nd, is what it was. And he didn't. So then they were supposed to give the tenants a 48-hour notice after October 22nd when he didn't fix it and make it habitable under the law. But they didn't. They didn't red tag it. They're working with him because they don't want to kick everybody out. Meanwhile, they're paying rent to him because it hasn't been red tagged. So, you know, it's questionable if they can withhold their rent. Even though it's completely uninhabitable under the law, it's still, you know, they have to go. The tenants are scared, and they also, most of them have Section 8, so they have to follow rules. And there's a tenant or two that doesn't have Section 8 that are just paying out of their disability funds, you know, so 80% of their income, and they are not allowed to get food stamps. So, you know, they're just people who know how to make it. They're just tough people who know how to make it when they're poor, and they help each other out. But anyway, so yeah, they don't think there's that. The guy, the landlord, saying he doesn't have any money. He's not fixing the place up, so how is he going to pay all these people thousands of dollars under the city's relocation ordinance?
Have you, when I arrived at the scene, I was confronted with, I guess, the manager who insisted that the whole problem had been resolved. But in fact, I think the concern was from perhaps you and perhaps others was that there was an eviction in process. What's the story with that? Were these tenants being evicted as well, and are they currently facing
it? It was unclear, and they were supposed to come that morning from the city. But then the day before, apparently the inspector told one of the activists that he was not going to become, probably, he was probably not going to be coming in the morning, so they didn't even know if they were going to get a 48-hour notice or not. So we just went there because we wanted to draw attention to that fact, too, that it's just very, it's destabilizing to have to live like that in the first place with paying 80% of your rent, of your money to rent, but it's also destabilizing when you're living in a substandard illegal place and you don't know when you're going to get notice from the city, which is a 48-hour kick you out notice, you know. So we're just trying to draw attention and also everyone knows that he's behind on his payments to the owner of the property as he's buying it. So how is he going to be able to pay all these people? And, you know, this little crappy little property with these little cottages, I mean, he's getting over $10,000 a month there, probably quite a bit more than that, actually. But somehow, you know,
just can't afford to
be able to fix his place.
Can't afford to fix up the place. So,
and like I said, they haven't paid their property taxes for 3 years.
Right. What do you expect is going to be the outcome of this? Or are you still in touch with the tenants and keeping track of this? What any sense of what's going on?
Well, one tenant is has a lawyer, and so that lawyer now represents that tenant, is the face of that tenant with the landlord and the manager. And no longer has to, there was harassment happening there. There's other complications that are, you know, individual deals that were worked out with the landlord as verbal arrangements. But, you know, if this is going on the radio and if there's tenants listening, if you make a verbal agreement with your landlord, you have to write that down yourself. Even if they don't sign it, you have to write it down and document it, because a verbal agreement just won't hold up in court. And if you can show that you emailed that verbal agreement to a friend or even to yourself, you know, with the date when you email it to yourself on the email, then you can prove in court, and this is the bottom line of whether stuff's going to, whether the landlord's going to respect your rights, if he knows you can prove it in court. If you've got an email that you sent to yourself or someone else, it doesn't matter, it's just an electronic record that you had this conversation. It's best if you send it directly to the person you had the conversation with, whether they, you know, if they don't accept it, then they might say something back. But a lot of times they just ignore it.
Let me ask you this, Cynthia. Can you do it? And many people have, you know, cheap phones these days. Can you do it by recording the conversation that way?
It's illegal to record conversations in California, and they don't stand up in court.
Huh.
So the only way, and you know that, and the only way you can record a conversation, I mean, you can record that, and then you can write it down for yourself if you need that for your memory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then but you have to write it down yourself. There's no proof that it's accurate, because you can't submit that recording as proof that it's accurate, as I understand it. If you're standing on the public sidewalk, which it's very easy to do at that particular property, and you're having a conversation, the law is gray. It's a gray area whether you can use that in court. They don't have... they're not. If they don't have the expectation of privacy because they're on a public area, then you can record them without their knowledge, without asking them. But the courts are very, they're on the side of the rich, so they don't like it when poor people record rich people lying.
Now, you're also concerned, of course, with the idea of a rent freeze, rent control, action by the city council, and you were part of a large group of people who came to city council last week and tried to get a vote on a rent freeze and were turned down. Well, you know, the council.
Well, I think that is like for me, that wasn't my plan. That was someone else's plan. I went there to support it, but
yeah.
I believe it's better to lobby the individual people before you make a scene in public, because then you can say you tried everything. And if you're going for some kind of public record that makes, you know, some people, they want to make the council look bad or something, but it's like, you look bad if you didn't go and just talk to them first.
Mm.
You know, so I think that
so you may not.
You know, it would be nice to have a rent freeze and a moratorium and all that, but
yeah, it sounds like you disagree with the strategy they were using, but you were being supportive anyway.
Well, so the city of Sebastopol, which I think I already told you, the city council did put into play a moratorium on evictions and rent raises for over 6 months last year, or this year, and this year and last year. And the city council chose to do that. And it's complicated. It's complicated who it affects. It doesn't affect all renters. And the way that you get a moratorium is prescribed either by a local ordinance or a state law. I'm not sure, but, you know, there has to be a certain kind of majority, either a simple majority or a super majority in order to get a moratorium. And so, there's no way, it would be really hard for us to get a supermajority, which would be 5 on this council here.
Well, let me ask you this. What's coming up next in the next few weeks or months that you want to direct people's attentions to who are concerned about either getting their own rents frozen, reduced, or stabilized, or supporting those who are in that situation?
There's nothing you can do to get your rent stabilized. The only thing you can do is work for rent control. There's nothing else. I mean, you can try to get a rent freeze in, but we have a city council that most people don't believe that they will vote for that, because they wouldn't even admit that there was an emergency at the last council meeting. That was actually what council member Cron was proposing, that they vote on, I don't remember all the details. Just talk to somebody else about it.
Yeah, we actually covered it. But what I was really asking, Cynthia, is what's coming up next that you would advise people who are concerned about this issue to get involved with?
Well, the main issue that people have to get involved with is knocking on doors and canvassing tenants and building a tenant movement here. That's never happened. And that's the main issue, because without that, you'll never have anything in Santa Cruz, because that's the power base from which any kind of rent freeze or rent control or better city council is going to come. That's going to come from an organized tenant base. So that's the main thing we need help with.
Now, how can people help with that particular issue?
Well, the best way for them to help right now is to contact me. We're setting up canvassing schedules for the next 6 months in all parts of the city. So, you know, it's a long-term thing for the next year, basically. We have a big push on to organize tenants, but we need more capacity. So people can contact me at my website is Santa Cruz Tenants. If you just Google Santa Cruz Tenants, TENANTS, you will find my website. Rather than giving you the address, it's easier to find it by just Googling Santa Cruz Tenants, and that will be the top results on your search, you know, list. But if you want to know the actual website URL, it's www.santacruztenants.com. .weebly.com, but the Weebly throws people off of that. That's a free website.
Gotcha.
And so I have to put W-E-E-B-L-Y in my URL.
Any meetings coming up that you would invite people to attend, or any more?
Every single city council from now on throughout the next year, it is extremely important that there be as many tenants present as possible. So it doesn't matter what's on the agenda, because there's always a public comment period, and it's really important for tenants to go. If they're afraid or there's other things they want to do, that's fine. But that's number one, is we need presence at our elected officials' meetings so they don't forget about us. We were just, because, you know, I feel that we had a little bit of a missed opportunity at the last city council meeting, because when they told us, you know, it was over, then everybody just filed out. It might as well have not happened in a way. And I'm sure you've had that kind of feeling before, Robert, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought you were going to have a rally outside, and I was wondering
what
happened.
I did.
No, I mean, after the council meeting.
Well, we were out there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we did do a little bit.
Did anything come out of that, or?
Well, we got some sign-ups, and, you know, what's supposed to come out of a rally afterwards?
Usually, I mean, this is what other activists advise, and sometimes I can actually follow their advice. If you announce another event that's coming up, that, you know, whether it's a barbecue or another
Absolutely.
Protest.
Absolutely. So we don't have organizing capacity to even have another event.
Gotcha.
I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been, Zob and I have been trying to convince people, you know, we need to have a calendar that's out 6 months, planning out, you know, 3 months in advance always. with events on it, but we don't have the capacity. And so somebody's going to listen to this program and from the California Apartment Association, and they're going to know that we're just a lame, unorganized group of young people who don't have any experience, and they're not listening to the older people in the group that have more experience, which I'm not one of them. You know, I'm not that experienced, but there are people there who understand how to organize this group, and there are younger people who are worried about power differential and not having power, and that's causing the organizational structure to be taking extra long time. But the problem is, this is a campaign where we're behind by 2 years. Most places, it takes them 3 years to get rent control. And so we're just trying to do it in a hurry, and we don't have organized tenants.
Well, I see you've got a lot of students involved. It seemed like, Cynthia, there were a lot of students involved in the protest. At least half the group that was there was students.
Organizing, I have to say, going on up at UCSC, and I'm actually working with them a little bit, but they're doing a great job, and because they have extreme, you know, they're suffering a lot too. They're a different kind of population than the folks living on the sleep tight, but they're all tenants. They're all pay a landlord, and the students are really and some of the professors in the sociology department as well are really helping the students to be involved with this issue on their own behalf, because these students are, unless they're from a really upper middle class family, they're going into a lot of debt that's going to last for a long time by going to UCSC because of the extreme housing. And they issue the highest amount of debt. They like to call it financial aid, but they're issuing debt to students at a higher level than I think almost any other UC because it's so expensive to live here. So these students are indebted. And here's something that happens, Robert, for those, you know, who are listening to this. This is a good thing to hear, but I understand there's a statistic that's been quoted to me. I haven't been able to take the time to check it out, but I'm pretty sure it's a real statistic because several people have told me that 50% of the Latino students who, you know, are admitted to UCSC, they leave after 2 years because they can't afford to live here. It has nothing to do with their academics. They can't afford to live here. Then they go home and, like, for example, this happens. This one young man went back to San Jose, where he was from, you know, Santa Clara County, and he got a job because he needed to start paying down his debt, and he probably was living with his family. And then he tried to enroll at San Jose State so he could at least continue his college education, but because his debt was so high from UCSC, he was not allowed to enroll. His debt was too high. He could get no further financial aid because they issue such high debt to the students at UCSC that ruins their credit. And, you know, colleges only allow you to have a certain amount of debt when they issue you financial aid. So it's just a ruining generations, you know, of people when they go to UCSC. And there was a woman crying at that meeting, and the city council was, maybe because she's Latina, they didn't seem that interested, but they jumped right on it when the first guy who went up there, who seemed to be a white gentleman, you know, and I have nothing against him, and I was really proud of him for just going up there and talking about his problems with his landlord, and right away they sent somebody, ushered someone out there to talk with him, which I was, you know, that was maybe the first time I've really seen that. He was reporting, you know, what happened, and the inspectors didn't go to the place, which happens a lot. And so they sent someone out to speak with him right then. But there was another woman, young woman there, and she had a different kind of story. And there was no rushing to try to help her, you know.
Well, you know, I think we saw it, Cynthia, at city council. I wasn't at the council meeting, but I saw it on the tube. Or maybe I think I saw it afterward as a video. But I saw that, you know, when there was this really angry and heartfelt story, there were many angry and heartfelt stories told at oral communication last Tuesday or Tuesday before last. But this one particularly, that, you know, I think David Chirazes, who's sort of the brains behind the reactionary, or some of the force behind the reactionary momentum at city council, in my view, you know, he said, well, can we send somebody out to talk to that person? And I saw sort of a... I don't know what happened. I don't know if any kind of agreement was reached. I wasn't there to interview
anyone. Right, and so that's another, like, that was a missed opportunity for us. I couldn't just run out there at that point, and I don't think that Zob did either, but Zob or I should have been out there to be with that person to witness, you know, what was going on. But like I said, Robert, because we don't have organized tenants, we haven't been able to build capacity, so maybe there, instead of two of us, there'd be eight of us organizers who know what to do.
It looks like it's growing, at least based, that's the first solid movement I've seen of tenants at City Council. Maybe I'm missing something, I probably am, but in quite a while, and I hope you continue. I know that you were originally only going to talk to me for 10 minutes, and I think we've gone on to 25 or something. So
oh, yeah, I got to get going.
I do want to thank you for taking the time, Cynthia. And again, I will remind people that if you Google Santa Cruz Tenants, you can find your website. I guess Zob has another organization. There's a student organization. I guess you can find all those different groups by starting by gut to go to Santa Cruz Tenants.
Yeah, just go to me, and I can tell you all the other contacts. I mean, hopefully we're going to all be under one umbrella soon. You know, all the tenant organizations in town will just be under one name and have different branches, which is the idea. That's how you organize the tenants. But the students are doing a great job, and we're working really closely downtown and university, and because the students are both places. So that's really exciting, and it's really necessary for passing rent control and organizing tenants. So, you know, just one thing before I go. The UC Santa Barbara, they have a really great, it's called the Isla Vista Tenants Union. It started with students, and they got the university to use student funds to pay for a tenant lawyer. So they have actually access to a tenant lawyer for people who are in the Isla Vista Tenant Union, which is a combination of students and non-students. And so, you know, that is an interesting model for the student part of our population.
Yeah. It seems it's always a little dangerous to have your adversary supplying the funding for the lawyer, but I hear you.
Well, too, but it's funded by student body funds. So students pay a fee, and then they get to vote on what their money goes towards.
That sounds good.
They have a little bit of power over that, I guess. But, yeah, I don't know the whole thing. Yeah, but right. But anyway, they have a good thing going on there. And
well, I know I'd also like to have you talk with me in the future about your research into rent strikes, which was something I suggested, a little more radical approach. And you've gone into that briefly in emails with me. Maybe we can talk about it next time we get together.
Yeah, I mean, I can send you. I actually posted about 5 rent strikes on the Santa Cruz Tenants webpage about last week. And because they were all in England at different universities in England. They started in this one in London. And that person who was really organizing it, he called in to our tenant meeting, and we did a really great interview with him about a year ago.
I think I was at that meeting, actually. I'm not sure.
It was at the SEIU Hall on Mission Street.
Yeah, maybe. Well, let's leave it for another time, because I'm keeping you long past your deadline, and I'm also probably past mine. So.
All righty. Great. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I hope it was helpful.
I think so.
Right. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was C.M. Berger, who's been working on tenant organizing, also been writing letters to the Sent Anal or Sentinel. And you're tuned to Free Radio, still 101.3 FM. So there.
Families to move in and give him 30% question. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord? What's the name of these waters toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man? While the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil. They vowed they would stop the rent collection. They vowed they'd bring this madness to an end. And when one blew the two born of distress, he soon found he had a thousand friends. With calico skirts, masks upon their faces, on horseback, armed with knives and guns. They chanted and they yelled, and they kept their farms, and they kept the sheriffs on the run. They asked, who gave you the right to be a landlord? Live on land when these waters toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man? For the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil. The landlords buckled, sold their holdings to the farmers in the hills. Yes, they overthrew this feudal system, but it's replaced now by speculators and banks. And you can still hear the homeless families asking of all the landed gentry in our ranks, who gave you the right to be a landlord? Come to the land of these waters toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man? While the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil. Who gave you the right to be a landlord? Come to the land of these waters toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man? While the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil. Who gave you the right?
That was David Rovick's Landlord in a YouTube version that was published in February of 2015. And he writes, in the 1840s, the rent strike among the tenant farmers or peasants of upstate New York changed a lot of things. It's high time for more like that. And that almost brings us to the end of this show. Boy, I thought we had a lot more time. A lot of things happening. There's a continuing trial in Sacramento against their camping ordinance, led by erstwhile attorney Mark Maron, uncovered somewhat extensively in the local papers there. I'm going to try to cover that on Sunday. I do a long show, 9:30 to, as I said, mid-morning. Actually, no, mid-afternoon. Maybe 2:30, who knows? In the past, I've had to fill shows with flashbacks because of a combination of health problems and, I don't know, weariness, maybe disinterest. I think it's mostly been health problems, but who knows? We all change as we progress along, and we'll see how I'm changing. Anyway, some stuff that may be coming up will be... a little bilingual discussion from Wes White's activities in Salinas, fighting anti-homeless laws. The interview with Berkeley activist Carol Denny, or first they came for the homeless poor tour activist Mike Zint, or somebody at the Here and There encampment, to see how that has worked out for folks who are now, well, by the time of the Sunday broadcast, they will have been past the Friday deadline for leaving the encampment where they have been, I should say, where the Here and There folks have been there, and then there will have to be some other there. Interviews aplenty from the Food Not Bomb scene on the weekend. I remind you that Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6, Food Not Bomb still feeds at the post office. Go down there and check it out. Mentioned before, I'm hoping to play a long interview from the protest, which Cynthia Berger and I both were at on Tuesday in front of the Sleep Tight Motel. I guess it's not a motel anymore. It was apartments